Welcome to another episode of the Colorado Bowhunters Association podcast. I am here with a very special guest, a person who's intimately familiar with hunting in Colorado and has recently become one of my favorite hunting content producers on the internet at large, Cliff Gray. Welcome, man. Thanks for spending some time with us today. How are you?
Yeah, of course, Jake. Thanks for having me, man. That was talk about a nice intro, man. I'm glad you like the content. That's been a little bit more of my focus in the last 6 months. So I always love to hear positive feedback on it, man.
I've noticed, and I was going to wait until later in the podcast, but now that it's come up, I do have to say your content is the most direct, deliberate, straightforward, non-fluff, well-produced. The audio quality is good. The video quality is good. And the information is not information I've seen other people put out there. One big one was like hitting the SOS button on a Garmin inReach. What actually happens? How to tell what the wind is doing if you're looking at an aspen tree, like stuff that just other people aren't talking about. I really, really love your stuff, man.
Cool, man. Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because it's not, I guess, you know, I'm very much, I would say, on the learning curve of figuring out that world. So like sourcing ideas, I've honestly just been, I just sit and I'll talk to like people I've hunted with or guys that used to work for me or whatever. And just ideas pop up and I'm like, yeah, maybe that'll be unique or a little tidbit for somebody. And then I put together a video. So I haven't really, you know, formalize that process, but it seems like, you know, particularly the type of video that you mentioned, there's a lot of people out there that like them. So good deal.
Yeah, man. We'll dive a little bit more into the content process, but before we jump into that, I kind of want to get to know you a little bit more. I'm curious of like where you grew up, how you entered into the world of hunting. And just for a little bit of context, I actually reached out to like Flat Top Wilderness Guides when I found out about you, hadn't known that you had sold the business. And I ended up doing a podcast with Jimmy and Evan out at at the outfit, at the barn or the guide camp. And man, sure, those guys are great. And that place is beautiful. Did you build that?
Oh, you can't, you went up to the ranch there.
Yeah, man.
Oh, okay, cool.
Did you build that home that's on that property?
So I didn't build it. It's kind of like, we could probably spend a whole podcast talking about just that, like how I ended up with that place. I don't know like the exact dates, man, but we're talking like roughly a decade ago, I bought that. And that place was, so the quick and dirty of that place is there's always been really big outfitting permits out of that location.
That exact location?
Yeah. So there'd always been people outfitting out of there, and they had a pretty robust business out of there. It's a pretty unique access point to the Flat Tops. And yeah, I actually knew about it as a kid. So the kind of the original people who established those permits in that area, they owned it. My father was a cattle rancher out of Eagle, and he had his own kind of smaller scale outfitting business when I was a kid. So that, you know, that was on the other side of Highway 70, but everybody was familiar with, you know, kind of the folks that were outfitting out of that, let's call it like southeast corner of the actual wilderness area. So it was, you know, to just like finish up the story, basically what happened, Jake, was I had been my early 20s, I was in a totally different world. I mean, I grew up around cattle ranching, hunting. I've hunted my whole life, man. And just to give you like a color of my childhood, for a bunch of different reasons, it was kind of partly there in Eagle and then partly in Northern California. So those were my two spaces as before I was an adult. So I lived in both those worlds. But anyways, in Eagle there, I went and did totally unrelated things in my early 20s. I worked in finance. I honestly didn't even personally hunt for a few years there. I thought about it a lot, but I had other things going on in life. And then I owned part of a financial business with one of my brothers. I sold it and I went to California, or went back to Colorado there in Eagle. I had some roots there. Me and my wife went back there. We didn't have kids at the time. And we really just went back there to have fun and kind of like be an interim period in our life, I guess, you know?
And was that a bit of like burnout? Because I come from New York, New York City, and moving out here was like just a breath of fresh air.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I was for a kid that grew up in a rural environment for, you know, I went to undergrad in an urban environment, and then I worked in basically a very urban environment too. So I think I was always like longing to get out of it. And that's probably why I sold that business. It was just like, yeah, probably not. I mean, I actually love finance. I love like the intellectual stimulation that goes, you know, is in that industry and that crowd. I have nothing against it. My brother's still in the financial stuff. So I don't have any issue with it in that regard. There's things I miss about it, but it just didn't fit my personality or lifestyle with the fact that I basically have to be outdoors. Right. So at least for a portion of my life. So it took me back there. Me and my wife were skiing. You know, we were basically came back to Vail and Eagle just to ski, have fun, you know, do some hunting, all that stuff. I was going to catch up on it. And the reality was, I don't know, maybe 2 years I was there, Jake, and me and my wife were skiing probably 130 days a year or something like that. Whoa. And then I kind of got burned out on that a little bit. Well, not, I wouldn't say burn out, but just, you know, as a young guy, you're always like
stimulation.
Looking for a new thing to do. And I drove up there one day to the ranch that you've been up to. I drove up there. It was like a third season, but it was like an early winter type of third season. There was a bunch of snow on the ground, like up there at the lodge. There was, you know, there was like knee deep snow or whatever. In the there was an interim owner that had bought the business, and I think he didn't really have the intention of running it, you know, full scale. He just kind of bought it. He was an adjacent landowner. Anyways, I ran into him, and I just happened to ask him, like, "Hey, man, you ever had any interest in selling this?" And he's like, "You better effing believe it." And, wow. And then two months later, I owned it. And, you know, he, for just like a ton of different reasons, a lot of what you saw up there was new. Like, you know, everything has been redone. I wouldn't say like the previous owners, like, you know, drove it into the ground or anything. They just weren't really that interested in having, you know, a real robust outfitting business. So we kind of turned it around, I guess, and fixed it up. And it's a beautiful place, man. I wish those guys the best. You know, I keep in contact with Jimmy and Evan still to this day.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous up there. And you're right, it is like a unique access point. I was telling you before we went live that I got a cow out of the flat tops this year as well, but I was kind of more in like the northeast corner of the flat tops. It's a huge piece of wilderness with like the largest elk herd in the world. So it's quite an interesting place to like operate out of. Your father's guiding and cattle ranching that gave you some confidence to going into owning a guiding business? It seems like a huge pursuit.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess for anybody out there, I mean, if it's, you know, there, you probably have some listeners that are interested in like, you know, how do you get into the guiding and outfitting business or how that all goes down. You know, that type of outfitting, Jake, the reality is that if you're confident on the livestock and the logistics end of things, that's actually much more important than like the hunting and guiding component. I mean, I had done a lot of guiding and I had done a ton of hunting in my lifespan, so I wasn't like really worried about that. And then the thing is that's like all your wilderness outfitting, if it involves horses and mules, anybody can do it and anybody can pick it up. But if you don't have a background in horses and mules and packing, it's going to be really, really hard. And so I had that, you know, I had that, just as a kid, you know what I mean? I've been around, my family always owned horses and mules, you know, for my entire life, and not just like one or two, like, you know, like 50, you know what I mean? So it was a component of our existence. So I felt confident because of that. And anybody who looks at a business that way, you know, you got to have somebody on your team or something that knows the livestock business and the packing business. Now, having said that, man, anytime somebody gets into the outfitting business, usually it's because they're slightly naive You know what I mean? Like they're slightly naive, and I was in that boat too. You know, there's a lot of things about that business that took me 7, 8, 9 years to learn. You know, there's just a big learning curve to it. It's a very, you know, 9 out of 10 outfitters you talk to will tell you like, it's a horrible business. It's tons of work and you got to deal with people and it's dangerous and there's all these uncontrollables and all that's true. But you know, the reality is that's true about a lot of businesses. That's not just outfitting. Yeah. And there's a ton of silver lining, right? Like you're always in the outdoors, you got endless adventures and there's a lot of like advantages to it. So you got to view that as part of the deal. But if anybody who gets into it knew what they were getting into in terms of the workload and stuff, they probably wouldn't rationally do it. But so you got to go into it with a little enthusiasm and probably being a little bit naive. And once you're in it, you're in it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. I just had a podcast that came out today. I interviewed Giannis Patelis from Meat Eater, who was a guide in the flat tops in Colorado for a while. And he said when he first started guiding, he was probably taking guys out who had more elk hunting experience than he had. And the outfitter needed like a warm body to take these guys into the field.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how that like trial by fire, I think that is true just with hunting in general, right? I watched hunting videos for 5 years and then I hunted. And that first day of hunting was like more information than the first 5 years. Cause you can't apply any of this stuff of what these guys are talking about if you've never been even close to that scenario. So I do think that boots on the ground is really the game changer. I'm curious, being a person with a finance background, did you like sit down and crunch the numbers of this being a viable business and how to make that work, how many hunters you need to book? And I know that with Colorado, if you're not using your permits, they'll take them from you and then you can't get them back. So I'm curious how you like figured out the financial piece to this adventure life.
Yeah, so I did, man. And it's funny because the business component of it is just as interesting to me as the hunting component of it. I mean, I love hunting. It'll always be a massive part of my existence. So I don't want to discount that, but so will entrepreneurship and business. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I looked at a lot of outfitting businesses beforehand. I just briefly looked at them. None of them were of interest. And even when I owned the Flat Tops Wilderness Guides, I looked at a ton of businesses all over the U.S. to expand. I operated before COVID. I operated in British Columbia a bunch during the spring. I looked at buying outfitting businesses there and, you know, maneuvering through all the, you know, there's a whole additional complexity there, particularly if you're American and not a Canadian citizen. So I looked at all that stuff. And to answer your question on that particular business, yeah, I mean, I did the numbers and I could make it work. Now I could make it work because it was like a turnaround deal. You know what I mean? It was like
turnkey outfit.
Yeah. Well, no, No, excuse me. It wasn't turnkey. It was like it was a turnaround. Like I could buy it for, you know, a lower price, and it was a different, you know, different world too. Back in,
you knew there's value you could bring to that outfit, being organized and making it a little bit more efficient.
Yeah. I knew there was growth opportunities. I knew there was a lot of ways like it could be efficient, and then I could just grow revenue a little bit. So it was possible. And the only reason I mentioned that, Jake, is because the outfitting business is a business that, for sure, people generally think their businesses are worth way more than they actually are. You know what I mean? So if somebody ever gets into it, you really have to grind the numbers and you have to be opportunistic because, you know, the guys that are making a good, you know, a decent living on it, most of them don't want to sell. You know what I mean?
And sure, sure.
Guys that have, you know, are really having a harder time, you know, they don't really want to sell either, but you need to catch them whenever they don't have a lot of other options. And usually that's about like December 15th after a hard hunting season. That's when you want to buy an outfitting business. You know what I mean?
Yeah. For those listening, that was yesterday. So get on it.
Yeah. Don't go looking for one, you know, in July or something like that.
Yeah. it is fascinating because it's so much more. In talking to Giannis about his guiding experience, it's like one additional layer to the hunting experience, because you're going out and you have these hunting experiences and wildlife encounters, but you also have these clients you're managing, the livestock you're looking after, the kind of somewhat responsible for the quality of the experience that these people are having. All these people are coming in with different fitness levels, different experience with livestock and horsemanship. So it's so much, I could see how it's such an intriguing thing, so many moving aspects to manage and monitor. Probably that's where some of the naivete comes in, is like not seeing every single piece of it before you fully jump in.
Yeah, man. I mean, guiding, I think most people look at, like, when they, if you haven't guided a lot, I think, you know, a lot of people probably look at it from the wrong perspective, right? Guiding is not being like, I'm a phenomenal elk hunter. And, you know, I'm the best elk hunter on planet Earth, and I'm going to take people and we're going to kill elk, and I'm going to be the best guide ever because of that. That's so far from the truth. It's not even relevant, right? Like, if you're out there approaching experienced outfitters as a guide and that's your approach, like, I'm just a phenomenal hunter, you're most likely not going to get a job, because anybody in the business knows, like, that's not what it's all about, right? Mm-hmm. There's a whole different skill set that's related to being a good hunter, knowing the basics, but also being able to manage, you know, a client that you're hunting with. And that's, you know, one, just making sure they have a good time. You know, all the interpersonal skills that go around that, but also, you know, hunting in a way that they're capable of, or hunting in a way, you know, that they're going to enjoy doing, all that while still keeping your success rate. That's like the gold standard for a guide. It doesn't, you know, like, how guys tend to get stuck on this, like, I'm such a great hunter. Well, maybe, maybe not, but that's not all that's relevant. What's relevant is this other component, or, you know, or at least it's more relevant than most people think. And the best way to think, you know, man, if a guy wants to really love guiding, this is my piece of advice. So there's guys that want to hunt with a rifle, and then they get where they want a little more challenge and they hunt with a muzzleloader, or they want more opportunity, they hunt with a muzzleloader. And then they want even more of a challenge, they want to hunt with a bow and they want more opportunity, so they hunt with a bow, right? Where they want more challenge and more opportunity, so now they're archery hunters, right? And so to me, the progression of that is being a guide, because it's harder than all of that in one, you know, in one zone, right? And it's kind of like just a natural progression, you know. And I'm obviously biased, Jake, but the best hunters on this planet are guys that have done a lot of guiding, because they get just days, you know, just reps in, right? And the fact that they've had to do everything that everybody else is doing with the challenges of clients. And I'm not saying that all clients are bad hunters. I've hunted with clients that were phenomenal hunters, but it's still two people. It's still dealing with, you know, their, you know, all the little issues of, you know, if you're, say you're on a backpack hunt, you got to deal with how they're feeling that day, or, you know, how their, you know, how their stress level is, all of that stuff. So when you all add all that in, man, to me, it's like the next level. And you, if you do that for a long time, you get very proficient at it, you know? And, some of those guys, like you mentioned, are not very well known. You know, you said you interviewed Evan. Evan Koster is one of the best elk hunters in the West, hands down, like 10x. I know, because I've seen the data set, you know, Jake, and no one knows about him. And that's not a huge interest of him, of his, is having a bunch of exposure. But if you take your average Colorado elk hunter and put him up against Evan is literally going to be 10 to 15x more successful in like a percentage way. So there, you know, you do get this big gap. So anyways, man, that's my biased view on that.
No, I appreciate the insight. And just to kind of add on to that, talking to Evan, he grew up right down the street from that outfitting business. He knows that area like the back of his hand. He obviously has developed the emotional intelligence to work with clients and guide people, as well as have a boss and have an owner and all these, you know, he's got all these moving parts to deal with. But the thing I noticed about him, and there's a theme amongst like true killers, is there's a quietness. There's like a humbleness. There's this feeling of, and I even had it this year for my first time killing a bull elk. I didn't feel the need to tell everybody about it because I did it. It was inside of me. I was like, oh, I have that. I don't need to like explain to you that I have this thing. I got
it. Sure. Yeah,
sure. I'm curious about like local knowledge. I see that you have your pilot's license. Did you ever utilize flying a plane to scout? I'm especially curious here in Colorado. We have a decent amount of landlocked land.
Yeah. So, in the flat tops, I didn't. The reality is that, you know, locating, you know, elk and deer out of a fixed wing aircraft, particularly at, you know, the high altitude and rugged mountains, it's just hard. You know what I mean? So I didn't, to be honest with you, man, I didn't do a whole, I'm not a really, really proficient mountain flyer, you know, particularly high altitude. So yeah. I didn't utilize it for that. Now, having said that, I mean, I love flying, man. You know, really in the perspective, or from the angle of that, I have flown for a while, you know, in the summer, like looking for sheep or whatever. I've flown areas and with, you know, typically with people who are experienced mountain flyers, you know. So I've done that and seeing goats out of airplanes and stuff, and that's awesome. But I never did it as a big, you know, it wasn't part of how I did things. Now I had kind of a I was doing a bunch of wintertime free range oddad hunts down in Texas, and we would scout out of helicopters actually a lot there, and it's a blast, man. It really is. I always thought maybe if I had another lifetime and was, you know, 20 and single again or something, you know, an outfitting business that was plane based would be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was telling my girlfriend the other day, I was like, I need to get one foreign hunt in before we like settle down into this next stage of our life. But whether that's like Alaska or Hawaii or New Zealand, like I want to go somewhere and like get that bigger version of it. It seems possible here in Colorado, and I haven't looked into the pricing of it, but there are some areas where I was like, man, if me and like 2-3 people split like the cost of a plane for 4 hours and just flew over this and took photos and videos, not necessarily like there's an elk, let's go for him, but more like that's an interesting area or that's an interesting access point, just to kind of differentiate that Google Earth image. But I don't know if that's the best use of finances. I don't know if that's the best use of my funds.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends, right? So, you know, I guess my first recommendation on that kind of stuff is the high, warm mountains are really dangerous for small airplanes. Yeah. Like, and that's why you don't see like low powered airplanes like Piper Cubs and stuff in Colorado. Because they just can't manage those type of mountains in elevation. And it's just the density altitude, right? There's not, they don't, the performance of them is way down. But anyways, if you find the right person, man, it's absolutely a way to get to know an area, you know. In certain species, it makes a ton of sense, right? I mean, you have to, you know, depending on the area and wilderness area and, you know, when your hunts are and all that, like you got to make sure, you know, make sure you know the legality of it 100%, you know. But, you know, flying areas for mountain goats or something like that, I mean, yeah, that's awesome. You may find some there's areas in Colorado where, you know, even the biologists don't know where there's a little herd of goats that nobody knows about, or, you know, or some rams hang out somewhere or whatever. Yeah, man, it's a cool. And then those kind of things, dude, you got to look at is like, are they cost efficient? Probably not, but they're pretty fun, right? So yeah, you got to kind of add it in as the adventure, you know.
Well, it kind of leads me into my next thought, which is I realized coming out here by myself with no mentors and just kind of figuring it out, there was a point in time where my first season hunting, I was 6 miles back from my truck with like a huge pack on my back. My legs were absolutely shot and a Chevy F-150 or sorry, Chevy Silverado starts driving down the trail next to me. And I was like, I'm the jerk in this situation. That guy paid trespassing fees. He paid like $1,200 per person to trespass. So I don't have those funds. But what I learned in that moment, what I continue to learn, is hunting is not only about the knowledge and the craft and your skill set, but becoming efficient. How can you do this efficiently while still having that adventure, right? I don't want someone to have a gun on a tripod pointed at an elk and I come up and pull the trigger, right? That's not fun. But there's a level of, I got into this area, out of this area. I didn't waste any extra energy. I didn't bring extra weight. I'm aware of how other hunters are affecting game movement in this area. And for me, that's the puzzle piece that's really becoming exciting is, how do I do this with the same or less effort and increased success?
Yeah. So my thought on that, Jake, if you continue down like that path that you just laid out in your, you know, whatever goals you want to accomplish as a hunter, I think that you're on to like the 80-20 of mountain hunting, right? I'm not sure are you familiar with that concept? Like,
oh yeah, you want to focus it, like, on everything.
Okay. Yeah. If you want to focus on what actually matters, it for this type of hunting, right? Like the type of hunting you're doing, like the mountains of Colorado, pretty heavily hunted elk, you know, some inaccessibility, but also roads, you know, just a mix of different things. Being like a mountain man logistical machine, that is going to be how you get really successful. You know what I mean? The guys,
100%.
Yeah. I mean, and the reason is that there's always this trade-off, right? Like if a guy tells me like, I'm hiking in 12 miles into this spot and, you know, I'll be like, well, have you been there before? No, I haven't been there before. I'm thinking to myself like, all right, well, you could get lucky. You could get lucky and be in the spot, but 9 out of 10 times off the bat, you're going to be in the wrong spot. And now you've already roasted 6-7 days for the average guy.
Huge investment to figure that out.
Yeah. So like, just, I mean, that's an example, but most of the real proficient hunters in like the Colorado deal in the over the counter elk, you know, they know like a few different spots and they know how to efficiently get around those spots. If the elk aren't here, they're over here and they know how to do that. You got to be really wary of this, just like, particularly because the backpack thing is caught on fire, you know, and guys can do amazing things out of a backpack, but just because you put in 10 miles and 10 miles is, I don't know what your thought on it is, Jake, but I've done a lot of backpack hunting. 10 miles is crazy far, you know, like to get
especially
an elk
to start, to that be the starting point of now we're going to start hunting 10 miles in.
Yeah. I mean, I every once in a while I'll see like these.
Did I lose you?
Crazy, you know, not really rational, or they're making it up. You know what I mean? Because you kill an elk 10 miles in, you got like a real problem if you're by yourself.
Yeah, you know? Cut out there for a second. I think what you were saying is that you see these stories of guys who are going 10 miles, 15 miles back and talking about all the success they've had. I'm kind of in that same boat where I want hunting to always be fun. It can be type 2 type of fun, but for me, it's like, I don't need this to suck for the sake of sucking or for the sake of me telling everybody how difficult this was. That's not why I'm in this. And I also realize on those hunts where guys are like, oh, I killed an elk in Alaska, 6 miles from my camp. It's like, you took out 200 pounds of that elk. You didn't take out 600 pounds of meat from that thing. I just know it. Whether or not you're the best hunter in the world or not, no one did 2-3 trips back into, you know, so there's some of that like bravado machismo piece of it. I mean, with my bull elk this year, I killed it on September 2nd. I recovered it on September 3rd. I finally got all of it out of the woods on September 4th. And ultimately, after getting it home and cleaning it up, my yield was like 20%. And I was so bummed about it. But it also made me realize, oh, all these guys talking all this stuff, I think there's some truth that we're not seeing when the camera isn't on.
Yeah, it's And for me, man, like my real, I mean, the main way that I look at that is that it's not a real efficient way to hunt. Even in a pretty remote, like Colorado environment, you know, particularly in a lot of Colorado, because the minute you get past 4 or 5 miles, you're going to run into the outfitting pressure. You know what I mean? So I guess one of the points I was trying to make in there, in addition to what you said, was that don't correlate the amount of effort with like success all the time. Like the amount of physical effort involved, you can't correlate that to your anticipated success. You know, just because you can hike further than everybody else, it helps to be able to hike some, you know what I mean? Be able to get some remoteness and be, you know, have a thick enough skin to deal with that. But, you know, just because you're getting somewhere where you think nobody else will, that doesn't necessarily mean there's elk there or you can have success there.
That's the other thing I'm starting to learn is sometimes when you're driving through a unit and you see a bunch of hunters, they're right. Like you might be, this is so crowded, I'm going to this other place. It's like, everybody's here for a reason. I, in rifle season this year, killed a cow on the first day. And the second day I was backing it back to the truck, like 4 miles. And there was guys walking around the trailhead at 9 a.m. on the second day of the season, complaining about not seeing and killing elk. It's like, hey, buddy, go 3 miles down that trail at 4 a.m. and then sit there all day. Like, don't be talking to me at the trailhead on the second day of the season in prime time. So it is really interesting becoming more efficient. One piece of that was that same story I was telling you when I was on foot 6 miles back. I came back to that unit for rifle season and I rented an ATV. It's like $700 for 4 days in the trailer. And I was like, this isn't sustainable. I can't do this based out of Denver every year. So I sold my motorcycle and I bought an E mountain bike, one of those Bakus.
Oh, sure.
And now that unit, I can get to every part of that unit in 15, 20 minutes, which used to take me 2-3 hours with a pack on my back and on foot and all this. And that's where I'm like, that's where I can make better choices. If I can get, 4 miles apart in 30 minutes versus that be what I'm doing for the day, it just changes how much ground I'm seeing, how much experience I'm having, and how much knowledge I have of what else is going on around me in the unit.
Sure.
That pursuit of becoming like a true mountain man, especially for me, I'm a Jewish guy from Long Island. So that's not necessarily in my blood, maybe my ancient blood. But sure. I saw that you also have your WFR, your Wilderness First Responder. And for people who are not aware, that's basically an EMT plus some mountain rescue information on top of that EMS, EMT cert. Would you recommend that for Western hunters who are just guys getting after it, not necessarily trying to guide, but just who are out there, maybe solo, maybe with friends?
You know, it's a good question, Jake. I don't know that I have a really straight answer for you on it. I've actually recertified, I think like 7 or 8 times. I did it like a month ago. So I had this debate, man. I'm like, all right, should I recertify to keep it up or should I just do like some other medical training? I do think that it's really important for everybody, even if you're hunting alone or hunting, you know, with a buddy or just family. I do think like having basic medical training is a good thing. And I don't know, there's like lots of different angles to that. I mean, the reality of like a wilderness first responder, wilderness EMT, you know, this kind of stuff. And there's other like wilderness oriented, medical type of things, is a lot of what they're training you is like a process, right? Like a step-by-step assessment process. So that, do I need to clear somebody's spine before we get them out? Like these sort of things. So you can relay that to, the next people and people can get help and you can make an idea of, do the people need to be evacuated and all that. So I'm not sure that is super useful if you're not working in like a client-oriented environment all the time. Now, knowing how to get help in the backcountry, knowing how to stop bleeding, and then knowing how to, knowing basic like medical things, like, okay, this person has altitude, they think they have a panic attack, but they most likely actually just have like, you know, just the start of altitude sickness. Like knowing that little, those little things are really helpful. So I don't know, man, I think almost if somebody's motivated, they can kind of they can do a little self-education and probably know what they need to know. But taking one of those courses is handy too. I wish I had a more straightforward answer, man.
No, I appreciate the perspective. The other side of it is I think it's an 80-hour certification that's going to require like 7 days of your life, $500 to $800 invested. If you're not in a place that has these things, you're going to have to fly to it and carve out that time. And I would say for people, if you're interested, absolutely do it. It's been on my radar for a couple of years, and I think I'm going to pull the trigger at some point. But before you make that huge investment, build out two or three med kits, right? One for your pack, one for your truck, one for your wife or your friend or whoever. And then in that, do you have sutures? Watch a couple of videos on doing sutures. Do you have a quick clot? Do you have a tourniquet? Do you know how to use these basic items? Like you said, can you recognize the early signs of hypothermia, of frostbite, of heat exhaustion? Because those are the things that are going to be more applicable, not only to you, to the people you're with, but to yourself as well. Like for me, solo hunting, I am so acutely aware of every step I'm taking when I'm 4 miles from the truck by myself with a sharp broadhead, you know, knocked on my bow and arrow. There's a part of me that's saying, don't stab yourself. Don't roll your ankle. You got to get yourself out of here with or without an animal. You got to get yourself out of here. And so there's just this level of awareness that I think everyone can bring to the table prior to making some giant investment in some first aid training.
Yeah. And it's fairly basic. Like there people, I think there's actually just value in going through the mental exercise, right? People concentrate on the funniest things. You know, they'll open up their first aid kit and they'll have like, oh, these are like the 10 different things I use for blisters, or they're, you know, this stuff. And it's like, that's all good, man. Like, I get it. Like, you know, a blister can make a trip miserable, but a blister is not going to kill you. So the things you need, just, you got to think about the basic things that are going to kill you up in those mountains, man. One, like a bee sting could kill you. So you need to like know the deal. Yeah. You need to kind of know like that stuff. You know, heart attack can kill you, particularly if you're a family or a mix of group, you know, people, and bleeding can kill you. And the other one is just getting lost can kill you. You know what I mean? And having no communication. That's pretty much it, man. If you have those things locked down, your chances of dying out up there are pretty low. You know what I mean? But you have to kind of, you have to have those prioritized, man. Like, you know, it's not hard to have that, but like, I mean, to me, like knowing how to put on like a cat tourniquet, right? You can watch a YouTube video and know how to have one in your pack. And that seems to make a lot of sense to me for anybody, because that could save your life. If you stick 100%. A broadhead in your thigh, or you stick a, you know, the classic one is nighttime gutting an elk, or, you know, quartering an elk, and you stick a knife in your thigh. If you don't have a tourniquet, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And it's so simple to have one and know how to put it on. So I think there's little basic things, man. I think sometimes maybe we overthink a lot of little minutiae that is actually more about comfort in the mountains, and that's all good. But we don't want to think about that and accidentally overlook the stuff that's actually going to kill us. You know, like,
I think it brings us back to that idea of the 80-20 rule. You could apply this to everything in your life, but if you spend time covering that 80% of things that could go wrong, and not worry about that tiny little, well, I have three versions of moleskin in case, you know, the blister doesn't feel good. It's like, do you have aspirin? Do you have Tylenol? Do you have Benadryl? Do you have a tourniquet? I like that idea. It's like, and the same thing with hunting, right? Like, you could focus on getting the newest broadhead or the newest bow or the newest arrow versus, do you know that unit really intimately? Do you have a backup plan on how you're going to get in there? Do you have like a backup plan to the backup plan? I think it's easier to be attracted to the sexy parts of hunting, which is like gear and equipment and newness and bragging rights, versus like becoming super dialed with the things that you're focusing on. It's easy to get distracted by all the flashing lights.
Yeah. And it's kind of too bad, because there's a lot, there's a lot of things that you can simplify it, man. And in the end, you actually, you tend to enjoy it more too. I mean, it's funny to talk about this stuff, Jake, because, you know, even though I've been in, you know, the mountains and hunting and stuff for really like my entire life, and I have tons of repetition in it, I'm also like very much a OCD plus kind of conservative individual. I don't want to ever feel lost. I don't want to ever feel like a scenario can kill me. Like there's in the last 5-6 years of being in the mountains, if I had to spend a night unexpectedly, I wasn't going to die. 100% was not going to die. And to me, that's how I feel comfortable. And when I'm in that state, I don't have to worry about it. You know what I mean? Like, oh, hey, we're like trouncing around in the timber and, you know, oh, my inReach battery died and your inReach battery died. Oh, and my iPhone died too. Like, wow, this is a conundrum. You know, at least we can start a fire and like, yep, we're good to go. You know what I mean? That relieves a lot of stress.
100%. And in addition to that relief of stress, it allows you to focus on the task at hand better. So if you know that you're safe, you're prepared, your home life is okay, everything's going on there, then the thing you're doing, the pursuit of the hunt, can be the full focus versus, oh no, where are we sleeping tonight? Oh no, my sleeping bag has a rip in it. Oh no, I forgot my water filter or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
Just helps clarity in the backcountry. Yep. I want to be respectful of your time. I think we got maybe 10, 15 minutes left. I have a few, like, it's going to kind of be now random questions, but you're the right guy to ask. And I guess starting on that tip with safety and redundancy, one big thing a lot of people do is download a map on Onyx and go into the backcountry, and then that's it. And like, no paper map. If they had a paper map, they might not know how to read it. I'm curious what you do with that. Like for me, I've started to bring two cell phones, one with the new maps downloaded, fully powered and off and in my pack, for those places that I can't purchase or find a paper map. What do you do about mapping and batteries? And now the fact that we're so tied into this digital world, if you are going somewhere in a wilderness unit or some new place that you're less familiar with, how do you cover your bases there?
And you're gonna laugh at this, dude. And so is the audience. But so I carry an inReach all the time. Okay, so I have that. And then I carry my iPhone and I have downloaded Onyx maps. And then I always carry, in addition to that, I have a GPS watch on. And all that, I mean, all that really does, you know, people have different opinions about it. I don't find them super user interface. Like the usability is fairly low, but they could get me out of a jam because I got a compass on the thing that mine's pretty darn good. It's reliable. I've got that. And I can like, if I know I'm going somewhere, like if I know like everything, all else is about to die in terms of power, like my phone or whatever, then I can hit on like track and I can track back on it. Right. So all of those, and then plus I carry a power pack in my backpack so I can recharge my iPhone if I need. It's one of those power packs that's not a real big one, obviously, because I'm conscientious of the weight, but it's one of those ones that has the cords already on it. So it's like...
I just got one of those. I think they're so convenient because I'm always losing those little cables.
Yeah. So I've got like a lot of duplication there, right? Like the inReach could help me get out of a, like a jam because I could get a hold of somebody if I had to. And then my phone, the reality is, and I'm sure most people are like this now with Onyx and downloaded maps. I mean, that's what I heavily rely on for sure.
Yeah.
But if my phone were to die or something weird happened with the app or something, you know, just stuff happens with technology, I can recharge it up. I can depend on my GPS watch. So I have like a lot of duplication there. Let me think about this. So I don't carry topo maps anymore. Now I knew, you know, a lot of the last, you know, 10 years of my life, I knew the areas that I was hunting really well. You know what I mean? So I didn't need to have a topo map as like a backup to Onyx or something like that. I hunted Idaho this last year a little bit. Like I did carry a topo map and, you know, just as a backup or whatever, but yeah, that's pretty much, does that cover that, Jake?
Oh yeah, no, that covers it. I'm always just curious how people do these things, because there's also, there's some people who are like, a goal of mine, Cliff, is to be able to do ruck with 75 pounds for 15 miles, which I think is an insane distance and weight. It's a lot. But the point of that is I could get out of nearly any wilderness area in Colorado in a single day with all of my gear on my back. And so that's like, for me, in terms of getting to a point of safety and mental security, it's like, all right, if I walk, you know, 10 miles in any direction, I'll eventually hit civilization or a highway or a this or a that. You can't necessarily say the same for Northern Montana or British Columbia or Alaska or anything like that. But there is something about Colorado being like, there's some wilderness here, but also it's somewhat contained, you know, might be 30 miles by 30 miles. And that's a huge plot of land. But there is something about, on top of the redundancy and the safety, is like, I know I can get out of this. I can figure this out.
Yeah.
And with some of that, I'm curious if you do any of this, or maybe it's just so instinctual you don't think about it. For me, two things I do when I'm going to new places is I constantly look behind me to just like recognize what I'm looking at. So when I come back to a place, I'm like, ah, this is familiar. And then the other thing is, how is like celestial navigation? Like, what is the moon doing and what are the stars doing? And can I potentially, no headlamp, navigate to a known direction based on what I've already witnessed in the area? Not easy, not saying I could do that, but I just try to bring awareness to some of those things.
Yeah. So I, you hit on one thing there that I will mention in addition. This is like, it sounds petty, man, but having a headlamp and a backup, you know, battery, that's huge. Guys get so screwed up in the dark, you know what I mean? Cause you just lose all reference or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and guys will combat, like, I've heard this before from old clients I had, like, dude, my Onyx was telling me one thing, but I was so sure it was another direction. I just kept going the other direction. You know, like, you get so mixed up. So having light is key. Now on the other things you mentioned, I don't know that much about actual, you know, navigating via the stars, you know, in the dark. Now I use the sun all the time. Like, one of the first things that I intuitively do if I'm, you know, new, or it's like the first hunt guiding of the season or whatever, is I know how that sun's moving across the sky, which sounds minimal, man, but it's huge when you know, like, okay, I'm in an area where the drainages run basically like north south, and you know, now you know where, how that sun's moving across the, you know, across the sky, you can figure out a lot of things, you know what I mean? And the other thing I do a lot, Jake, is like, when I'm doing due diligence on an area, I really pay attention to, like, hey, like, I can come out the bottom of this drainage. I can come out of the bottom of this drainage. Now, sometimes you look at a drainage, you're like, I don't think I can come out the bottom of that, because the topography, cliffs out, waterfalls out, stuff like that. But that's huge, man. I mean, one, if you ever get in a bind, if you, like, somebody gets sick or something, whatever, you can get out the bottom. But the other thing, man, is like, I don't pack meat uphill anymore, period. Like, I will, if I can get out some hole that I've killed an elk in or something, I'm going down. And I don't, you know, assuming that I can communicate, you know, people need to know that are back up in a camp or something, like, they, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not going to make everybody's life miserable by not telling them where I'm at. But assuming I can communicate with them on a radio or inReach or whatever, I'm going out the bottom, because I don't, packing meat up is like, I'm just over it. So I go out the bottom. So I always know, like, how to get out. I mean, I've guided goat hunts, man, where I was, you know, I'm with the hunter. I'm like, they're like, well, how are we going to get up out of here? I'm like, we're not getting up out of here, man. We're going out the bottom of this thing. And it's like, well, what are we going to do when we get there? And it's like, we're going to hitchhike. You know what I mean? Like, that's how we're going to do this, because it's going to be 1,000 times easier. So I always do that due diligence, man. Like, I know exactly how I can get out of areas. And a lot of times also that you'll get a good idea of where your trail system is, like the flat tops particular, but a lot of places, you know, a lot of wilderness areas, they've been packed on so hard. There's pack trails down in every drainage. So if you go down towards water and you know what you're looking for. You're looking for logs that have been cut. You're looking for axe cuts or whatever. And you're just kind of paying attention. You'll realize like, oh yeah, I'm good. Like you can get out of most places.
It's so interesting, like how established some areas are. Where I killed the cow elk this year, my buddy killed a bull there the year before. And as a present, I bought him a USGS map from like the 1960s of that area. And there was a Jeep trail running through it. And I was like, I can't get back there on foot. Getting back there in the 1950s in a Jeep, like you have to be insane. So it's just so interesting to see some of the history of these places. To kind of piggyback, and then I'll wrap up with a few ideas. One thing I like to do is I'll make a project on Google Earth, and I'll pin a few things. Here's the trailhead. Here's trailhead B. Here's an exit. Here's an exit plan B. I'll then get like an angled view on it and try to print that out, and then I'll carry that with me just as the last backup plan of everything I have gets soaked and wet and destroyed or whatever. Here's this thing where I can reference, here's where the car is parked, and here's an exit plan, and here's an exit plan. But it also just helps with understanding the area a little bit. That cow I got this year was because last year I realized all of the hunting pressure was funneling elk in that direction. And like, there's nothing worse than wanting to redo opening day. You have to wait 365 days, but it worked this year. So it's really like, I don't know, it's helpful. I feel like I could talk to you for another like 3 hours about all these questions and ideas I have. I'd love to have you back on maybe 6 months, 12 months from now. I will ask you two more things. One, favorite style of hunting, weapon, animal, if there was one, not like you have to do it for the rest of your life, but just, I love being in the Rocky Mountains with a bow going for elk. Like, is there something for you that's your number one pursuit?
Yeah, man. It's going to be cliche, man, but I would say above timberline sheep hunting with a rifle. That would be it for me. You know, in, I guess, attached to that, what I would say is like probably a bucket list for, I have no interest. I mean, I've guided, I don't know, maybe 15-ish goat hunts or whatever. I really don't have any interest in harvesting one with a rifle, but I'd love to do mountain goat hunt with a bow would also be up there too. I can't say that that's like my favorite because I've guided bow hunters for goats, but I haven't done it or anything myself, but kind of a bucket list thing.
Oh, totally. It's so fun. And it's so interesting seeing them in areas when you're not in that hunting. I've seen them on top of ski lifts at Arapahoe Basin. I've seen them on the top of mountain passes that I'm driving through, and then they surround my vehicle. And I'm like, I'm sure if I had a bow in my hand, you guys would be nowhere to be found. But so one more thing, and then I want you to promote all of the stuff you've got going on, is I was curious if, and this might be too vague, but advice, not for new hunters, but for new-ish hunters. Those guys who are 2, 3, 7 years in, getting maybe some consistent success, still learning a lot. I'm curious if there's anything you have just generally to tell those types of people who are kind of in it, not necessarily veterans, not exactly newbies, but still learning, which we all are, I guess.
Yeah. You know, probably my biggest piece of advice, I guess it depends on what your goals are, but if one of your goals is just to get in a lot of, you know, hunting time and success, try to find somewhere, you know, that within your lifestyle, you can hunt a lot. So like if you're in Colorado, find a few areas that are, you know, reasonable, depending on, you know, if you can just do weekend hunts, then hunt somewhere close. And if you can do longer hunts, find somewhere else, but find a few spots and learn those spots really, really, really well. Like if you feel like, if you've been hunting a spot for 2 or 3 years and you feel like, I think I got this down, like hunt it for another 3 years, cause you're going to be super surprised, cause you're going to learn a bunch more. But once you've really grounded out in an area through good and bad times, your success, and I think really the quality of your hunts goes way, way up.
I really appreciate that. And the chairman of the CBA, Henry Ferguson, would really appreciate that answer too. When I was telling him about my archery elk success, I was like, I closed the chapter on this one. I'm going to go find a new area and start figuring that out. He's like, don't do that. He said, go back to where you shot elk for another 2 or 3 years. figure it out, get more success under your belt, and then go torture yourself with a new unit in a new location. And yeah. I was like, I'm still 50-50. Part of me wants to guide friends in the place that I was successful, so I still get the experience, and then I go have a new experience somewhere else. But that's the one thing that's nice with Archery Elk in Colorado. We get 30 days to figure it out.
Yeah, you have some time. Yeah, well, man, I go for it.
I was going to say, I would have so much more I'm curious about, but I can save it for a future one. One thing I wanted to promote or have you promote is all of the areas where people can find your content. I know that you have pursuitwithcliff.com and you got a newsletter on there and a blog on there. You have Cliff Gray on YouTube.
Yeah, man. So the three are, if you want to get on my newsletter, that's my favorite because I got direct contact with you. So go to my website, pursuitwithcliff.com, and the newsletter sign up is pretty much on every page. So you can stick your email in there. You can do that. I try to stay active on Instagram. It's Cliff, G-R-Y, C-L-I-F-F-G-R-Y. And then if you go to YouTube and you just put in my name, Cliff Gray, in the search box, my channel will pop up. Those are the three things I'm focused on and I try to keep up to date on.
Yeah, they're great too. And I'll put them all in the show notes so people can just click the links. I noticed that you've been guest hosting Jay Scott's podcast lately. Small world. I asked Giannis how he knew Jay Scott. Jay hired Giannis to be a fishing guide. And then they all started talking about elk hunting. And it's funny now that you are guest hosting his podcast. Do you ever think about doing a podcast yourself? I mean, you're a great orator. You have so much information. I'm sure you know a lot of people in the industry. You ever think about doing one on your own?
You know, I haven't, Jake, and that's because, I mean, I really like doing them on Jay's podcast. You know, he's got quite a bit of he's got a big audience, and his audience is for sure like an audience that's oriented to, I think it's a lot of people, you know, trying to learn, you know, like, and they could be different stages of hunting, advanced or whatever, but they're trying to learn things about certain species or whatever, like little nitty gritty stuff. So I like that. I'll be honest with you. I don't have a big interest in doing one, man, because I have to focus on what I got going on. Like right now, my focus really is the YouTube channel. And I could see that probably being the focus for a long time here. And I'm just not good at doing like multiple things. I think it's just how my brain operates, man. So I'll keep hosting them for Jay and I love doing it, but I'll probably just focus, you know?
I like to hear that, man, because what you're putting out is very high quality. I've learned a lot from a lot of people, but the density of information in your videos while it's still being entertaining is like spot on. So if it means anything, keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thanks,
well, I really appreciate you coming on, giving us some time. The CBA is like an awesome organization. You're an awesome orator for a spokesperson for hunting. So I appreciate you giving us some of your time, and we'll have to do this again a few months from now.
Yeah, of course, Jake. Thanks, man.
Thanks, brother. Have a great day. It's nice talking with you.
Yeah, you too, dude.